Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Queensland Gardening Hour with Gerry Colby-Williams.
Good morning.
Noel Burdett.
Good morning.
And me, LJ Stockwell. Well, we've been practicing our podcast for a couple of weeks and we're confident that now we can do it. And hopefully this one's, you're listening to it because it's been live on our website, Queensland Gardening Hour. So let's get started with what's been happening in your garden, Gerry.
My garden is doing really well at the moment. We've had some good rain, considering that spring is normally so dry.
Yeah.
I've been just amazed by how well things grow with that little bit of extra rain. So my garden now is green in a way that deciduous trees can only do in the first couple of weeks of putting on those new leaves, emerald green.
There's nothing like rain, is there? Like you can put the hose on a plant and it'll, you know, keep going, but suddenly rain comes and they look full of energy.
Look, I think this is the best spring I've had since I moved to Queensland. My normal things are happening, so all my winter crops, I've selected all the mother stock for seed saving. They're all in bloom. So if you get out early in the morning, as I did this morning when I was watering, the bees are absolutely going crazy. The sound is lovely. I took a few video clips of bees running along the long stamens of spider flower, pulling the pollen off. And look, I'm just really comfortable with the garden right now, which is not normally the way I am.
Well, it's very surprising for us in Brisbane to be having this quantity of rain in September. It really is a surprise, isn't it?
Well, I think the Bureau of Meteorology explained why we're experiencing
this. Oh, yeah, do tell.
Because we are experiencing a significant El Niño at the moment. The reason this is not like the last major El Niño is that the Pacific and the Indian Oceans are both warming. So it's fixing our weather patterns more or less in a normal way. So most of the action so far, most of the really severe cyclones have been occurring in Southeast Asia. And most of the frost and the drought has actually affected the highlands of Papua New Guinea. So there are quite severe things going on. But at the moment, we're in a little zone of calm. The East Coast has not had anything unusual so far.
Interesting. And what about you, Noel? Obviously, you had something dramatic happen in your garden yesterday. Do you want to tell us about that? Go on.
Oh, look, that was my own stupidity, really. I was just pruning a plant that had a bit of a toxic sap and it just happened to get into my eye.
So what did you do?
Oh, I was pruning things a little late. This is what happens, you know, when you're working all day in the heat and you come home and think, I'm going to enjoy my garden in the cool of the afternoon.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I just was happily doing things, so, you know, staying away from the internet and the computer for a little while.
What, was it completely dark out and you were just
No, I was just pruning it. Of course, the plant that I was pruning was a Euphorbia catinifolia. And,
yeah,
of course, most Euphorbia sap stop running in the middle of winter, and that's when I should have pruned it. But, of course, I'd let this one go due to being a little bit busier. And I thought, I'm going to prune this one today. And, of course, wasn't thinking. Got through three of them and went to the last one a little bit just squirted in my eye, and that was about it. Oh, it wasn't too much of a damage. As you can see, it's perfectly okay today. I'm alive and well and kicking and ready for more gardening. And that's what I've been doing.
Really, so tell us about what's been happening in your garden.
Well, I've been actually revelling, a bit like what Jerry was saying earlier about watching the bees in the garden. I've actually been revelling in my garden, just enjoying it for what it is. Sometimes we need to take that little bit of time out. So I've been doing the weeding, doing the mulching as normal, but not overexerting myself, because when your head's down, your bottom's up, you don't get to actually enjoy your garden. So I've been out there watching things grow. I have been absolutely in raptures, and it sounds very nerdy of me, but I've been really in raptures watching the march of the insects in my garden and watching them rise in population growth over the last couple of months. So it's been wonderful. I'm seeing amazing species of dragonflies in my garden, lots of different bees. Everything's happy. And when I see all the insects flying around and everything's being pollinated, I think, well, everything's right in the world as far as I'm concerned, even if that world happens to be within the boundaries of my property.
It is a spectacular spring in Brisbane, isn't it?
It is. It's been lovely.
Yeah, really interesting. You know, you were just saying then about talking about taking a bit of pleasure in observing what you do and resting and then letting that sort of permeate. And that's interesting because I have long chats to my lovely auntie who's 84, and only this week she's been talking to me about just settling a little and just enjoying the process of life, basically, and you're applying that to your garden.
This is something very important that I think we all often overlook, or we take for granted, and we don't give ourselves...
We just rush around all the time,
yeah,
don't we?
We don't give ourselves an opportunity just to stop and literally smell the roses, and we do need to do that.
Well, one of the things that contrasts so starkly between Queensland and England is that in England you get 5 months of cold weather when everything rests, and that's when you do all your project work and you catch up, and you're ready for that burst of spring, which really is an enormous burst. But here, there's just a change in seasonal demand. And when things grow, in summer particularly, when we get the warm, wet weather, things grow so fast. I think people don't realise how dramatic gardening can actually be here. I bought a hammock 11 years ago when I moved up here, because I just said, I'm going to enjoy the warmth.
I'm going to Brisbane.
I'm going to be a Queenslander. And the thing's still sitting underneath my house. I've used it three times because there's always so much to do.
Well, and winter's so short, so if you want to get anything done in winter, you've got to work.
Yeah.
So busy, isn't it? And then the heat comes, and then it's suddenly you're just dealing with the produce all the time because it's so full on.
Weeding and watering only.
Yeah.
True.
So now let's go to a question. Have you boys got some questions from people that would like to ask gardening questions?
I have. I brought... I brought a couple in today because they're quite seasonal. Jackie Wilson on the Sunshine Coast emailed me through my Facebook page. I live on the Sunshine Coast. Three times now I've been bitten by something mysterious in my backyard. I haven't ever been able to see what has bitten me. It leaves no mark, but the pain is incredibly intense and lasts for hours. Do you have any idea what may cause this? Well, my answer to Jackie is that I think you might be experiencing an allergic reaction to a plant, not an animal. Now, animals will leave some sort of a bite mark. There will be a damage to the skin. And if you're not seeing any damage to the skin, it's most likely to be a reaction. Now, human immune systems change over time. As we age, things that we used to be allergic to may disappear, and new things take their place. I'm experiencing just that sort of a change in life, where certain things are making me have really intense reactions, and there are no physical signs, and I've gone away and had tests, and this is what I recommend Jackie does. Speak to her GP, get some general allergy tests done so she can see which certain things are causing that reaction and find out what it is, because I'm pretty sure it's a plant, not an animal.
It's interesting you should say that, because up until recently I hadn't realised that I actually have a slight sensitivity to azaleas.
And, really?
And I love azaleas, but of course when I get close to them, all the little fine hairs on the foliage, if they get underneath your arm here, you'll find that I get a rash from
them.
Well,
there you go.
So, and yet I still love azaleas no matter what, but I am rather sensitive to the fine hairs on the foliage.
Interesting.
My grandfather couldn't touch primulas without wearing gloves.
Yes.
Otherwise, he'd literally have to go and have anaphylactic shock.
Yeah, the sap of the primulas, yes.
It's a jungle out there. What about you, Noel?
It's a dangerous jungle.
Garden when you go out and go armed.
Well, I don't have an exact question, but I've had several types of questions thrown at me for the last couple of months. Usually, they're generalised questions, like one in particular was, I've got a lot of dry shade in my garden. What can I plant in dry shade? It's a difficult spot. This is a common problem that we all actually find, though, over time, when we have trees that end up being, you know, getting to the level of maturity, they start to sap the lovely moisture out of the soil. There's not a lot of nutrition available, but there are options that people can plant, and I keep harking back to the same old plants that people first grew when they started to get into gardening, and they were simple things such as Aspidistra is one of the very, very best plants.
What's that one look like?
Well, it's a big-leafed lily-type plant, and it's a member of the lily family. It's a clumping plant. The leaves get to about 60 to 70 centimetres high. They look like a young palm, I suppose. They grow in very dark sites. They'll also grow in brightly lit positions, but not generally full sun.
Do they have a flower?
Their flower is very insignificant, quite small at the base of the plant, right down close to the soil. Mm-hmm. It's like a little starfish in the colour of pink. It's quite an interesting white flower, so you'd never grow it for that reason. But this is one of the oldest plants in cultivation. It'll grow in the deepest, darkest depths of a garden with no care, very little watering, which makes it perfect for growing underneath trees in shade.
But you know underneath a tree how it gets really compacted.
It can do, but sometimes you can work on it. This is by throwing on some extra soil, extra leaf mold, so to speak, letting the foliage fall down, being part of that soil structure helps with the friability of that soil and also the moisture retentiveness. Another good plant which is in flower right now are clivias. So clivias are brilliant for planting in the shade, in dry areas. I actually have a bright yellow clivia flowering and growing at the base of a bamboo right at this very moment in time. That just goes to prove how tough these plants actually are. They look delicate, like lovely little orchids, but really they are a lot tougher than what people give them credit for. So they're a really good option. So there's a couple of good options that people can plant in their areas. And one of the newer plants that people can buy and put in their position in this position as well is a plant called Zanzibar Gem. Now this is a Zamia calcus zamiafolia. It's a member of the aroid family. In actual fact, they're quite common. If you walk around any shopping centre, you'll see them in pots. They use them inside the shopping centre complexes. They look like a plastic fern, mm-hmm. but they're not plastic. They're incredibly adept to holding onto moisture. Really, really tough plant, but one of the nicest if used in mass. Really shiny. So these are three really good options that people can use for growing in the shade underneath trees, in dry shade in particular.
Well, that's interesting. Hey, let's move on now to a project that I've been doing here at my place. I wrote a blog post about it and it's had a lot of views, and so I think that it really has struck a chord for a lot of people. Mm. As both of you boys know, we've had our families lost two very beloved members in the last 2 years, both my dad and my sister. And my sister's anniversary was coming up and we decided to plant, start with planting a tree or something for her. And of course that grew into a bigger story where we ended up making a whole garden, and it's full of purple flowering plants. So hopefully, Noel, you'll give me advice on that as we go on about more flowering purple or pink, dark pink flowering natives. But I just thought it'd be interesting to have a chat to you both about really the healing powers of gardening, because while we were doing the project, my sister and auntie and I all noticed that we felt better about losing Rosie. And I think that's why it struck such a chord for so many people that have viewed the blog post, because everybody who's lost a beloved member and who's a gardener knows that feeling of planting a plant and watching it grow and remembering that person. So I thought it might be interesting for you boys to have a chat to us about what you know about grief and gardening.
Mm. Well, the first thing I'd say is it's wonderful for somebody to actually talk about this, because the gardening media do not cover grief and they don't cover depression. I've actually spoken to some very high-level editors about doing articles on just this, and they said, no, absolutely not. It's a no-go zone if you want to sell articles. So I thought, I'll have to leave it, because unless you can get somebody to publish an article, you can only do it yourself. Now, when you did yours, I loved it. I shared it on my public Facebook page, and so far it's had over 263 views and it's been shared 11 times. So this is something which is important to people. And I just thought I'd share a couple of other people's comments about
it. Oh, yeah, great idea.
Julie said, my garden is full of plants that my darling partner grew. My sister and brother-in-law planted a crepe myrtle tree in his honour. And Leonie said, my love of gardening started as a toddler. I was very close to my grandmother, Alice May, and we often gardened together, just like me. I started gardening with my grandmother. I was very close to her. She died over 30 years ago, but I, my mum and my sister and her son have all plants descended from cuttings I took from grandma's garden when I first married. I have a garden of alyssum, white and pink maybush for her. My hope is that my grandchildren will propagate their great-great-grandma's plants. Now, they've got the way in which gardeners often do. They have plants which they associate with people and certain times in their lives. And by propagating those, they keep the memory of those people alive. And I think it's true to say that as long as you share stories and have a connection with people that have departed, then they never actually go. They gain their immortality through the things that you share and grow. So I think it's a wonderful thing to do.
I totally agree. I believe that any plant or any act of planting or gardening can connect people with other people, whether they're present with us or not. And like you, my roots in gardening came from my grandmother, and this is why every year I grow calendulas in my garden, because that was the first ever plant that my grandmother taught me how to grow. So whenever I'm looking at those calendulas, it reminds me of my grandmother. I don't necessarily need a photograph on my bedside table of her. All I do is look at that plant, and I know, and I have all these vivid memories that come into my mind. Now, this is an important thing. Working in the nursery industry over so many years, and like you too also, Jerry, we have people that come in and they don't often know how to approach the question when they're looking for a plant in a nursery to plant in memory of someone else. So often you have to ask them questions and pry a little bit deeper to find out why they're looking for a particular plant. One of the top plants that people look for, two plants that people look for in memory of others are camellias and roses. Why? Because they are named. And more often than not, they're named after people, and they've got names. So they're looking for a name with the name like Margaret, or they could be looking for someone with Beatrice or John. So when they've got a plant that connects them with that particular person by name, it means so much more. Often when it comes to losing children, this is obviously a little heartbreaking for a lot of family members that do come in. When they've lost children and they want to plant something, they never say they're planting it for a child. But I'm a bit,
intuitive.
I tend to ask them questions and I get on why they're looking for a particular plant. And they say, oh, look, we've lost a grandson or we've lost a baby or what have you. I often say, in that respect, think of something white that's pure, that is a beautiful plant. And the magnolia little gem always comes to mind because the name little gem sums it up for them every time. They always leave happy. They always feel
like they've done, like they've got what they were looking for.
They've done something right. Mm. And even the other day, actually 2 weeks ago, a gentleman came in. He was looking for a particular plant and he was wandering around. I was watching him and I said, can I be of assistance? And he was ended up looking for a plant in memory of his wife that had died last year of cancer. And she died on the Sunshine Coast, so he was wanting to plant a tree in her memory on the Sunshine Coast in this particular garden. And I went through, I said, look, did she like to garden? Oh, yeah. Did she have a particular favourite plant? I think so. So asking all these questions, you start to sort of pinpoint and narrow down your options very, very easily. As it so happened, grevilleas were her favourite plant. So I said, well, why not choose a grevillea?
Yeah, because
every time it comes into flower, you will always remember her. Mm-hmm. And that's something that can really connect with her love of gardening.
One of the comments on the blog post was by a lady who'd had a lot of experience with terrible grief. And she said that she thinks that gardening helps because it's about the life cycle, and you have to, on whatever level you're thinking about, you know, life and rebirth and cycles, and, you know, gardening kind of shortens that all up, doesn't it? You know, as we as humans get to see it every year. And somehow I think that helps with grief too, that you can see that it's life.
I found the most thoroughly enjoyable day I spent gardening was actually with the kids at Cabramatta High School in Sydney. They were all refugees. Most of them had lost one or both parents. And it was for National Tree Day that we were doing this. And the thing that struck me, amongst many other things, was they're saying to me, it's so different living in Australia, where we can be out in the open during daytime and there can be a plane flying overhead and feel safe whilst planting a tree. It was a celebration of life and, for them, freedom as well. But it brings me to one question, which you haven't answered about your blog.
Yeah.
Why are you choosing the colour purple?
Well, Rosie looks spectacular in that sort of deep, purpley, rosy pink colour. So that's why I'm just using all that colour part of the spectrum. Okay. So from deep rose pink through purple.
How lovely. What a lovely connection, because there are so many different colours. There's a lot of symbolism in flowers. And purple and mauve is quite a royal or an imperial colour as well. So I thought possibly it was because of her status.
Well,
or
she
stature.
Certainly had that. There's no doubt about that.
And it's interesting that pink also means calmness. It also means caring. That's what it stands for. That's why we associate pink with motherly love.
Yeah.
And with love, actually. Pink also stands for love. I did a post on that only recently on colour. Mm. I do that occasionally on my Facebook page. But it's interesting. But there are some lovely, lovely plants that you can choose. I'm sure you've picked some delightful ones already.
Oh, and maybe you can help me with a few more.
Well, I think that's a great idea, that it's not just something which is done as a set piece. It's a continually evolving, living connection with those people, because they're never going to go while you're around.
That's right. And I chose things that, you know, some things that'll take quite a long time to get established, and then some quick things just for fun. You know, I just filled in with daisies and lavenders and things that at least in the next couple of years will have some flower and some show. But
Beautiful. They
can continue to be replaced with longer term shrubs and colour too.
But even if they're short term, it doesn't really matter, because they're giving you that beauty anyway.
Where can we read this again?
Oh, okay. So, how about I put it up on the Queensland Gardening Hour website so people can go and check it out as a blog post.
Thank you.
Okay, well, right now we're going to be speaking to a bit of a Brisbane icon. Everyone knows this lady for getting around with lots of children, carrying koalas and a whole assortment of native animals. And of course, she has been around, I think, on television for the better part of, 30 years. And, of course, this is Ranger Stacey, so otherwise known as Stacey Thompson. Welcome to the program, Stacey.
Hi, Stacey.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me on. It's very exciting on this beautiful sunny Monday morning.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Do you have a koala attached to your shoulder at the moment?
No, surprisingly, I don't. No, I'm just sort of without native animals at the moment. I'm just hanging out at home on a public holiday.
Yeah, Stacey, you have had an amazingly long-standing involvement in children's education. Why is it so important to maintain the children's involvement with all of the natural world?
It's just incredibly important. I think, you know, the earlier there's an awareness in children, I mean, it carries them through for their whole lives. And I think it's just such an important thing. And I feel proud that I've been able to play an important part, you know, in a small part, really, but in people's lives. And it's great now because I have been doing children's TV for, as you say, it's close on, well, maybe not 30 years, maybe about 25, 26 years. Those children have grown up and they're now adults, and some of those people have actually got children of their own, and I see it all the time. You know, I'm out and about and people will say to me, "I'm Ranger Stacey, I grew up watching you," or I go and do a Totally Wild story and, speak to a researcher or a scientist, a young one, and they actually tell me that I inspired them in some way to follow that line of work. So it's really, really great.
I totally agree with that. I'm sure you have inspired many, many hundreds of young people to get out there. What have been some of your highlights that you've experienced over the years with your involvement with children and, of course, the natural world out there?
Well, I think it's just really, with children and animals, it's the unexpected. You know, it's just the unpredictability of, especially with, my filming work, going out, and especially some of those wild adventures that I've had, traveling throughout many beautiful parts of Australia and overseas. But just, I guess, you can script things to a certain extent, but when it comes to, interviewing children or filming animals, you never quite know what's going to happen, and that's the exciting part of it.
That's right. Isn't that the old saying in TV, never work with children are animals.
Yeah, and I work with both.
But in this case, children make up the basis of your work. So this is the most important thing.
And it's great because they're so honest as well. You know, they just tell you how it is, and that's what I love about it. You know, so never there's never a boring day when I'm out and about. And I think that's why I have stayed in this field for so long, you know, and it's just so rewarding to, you know, to see people, you know, get something out of what I do and also just like to explore. I mean, I started as a little girl loving, you know, going camping and bushwalking and, you know, seeing turtles hatching up at, you know, around the Bundaberg area. And I think that's something that really triggered something for me, and I hope, you know, with what I do, it might help other people get the same sort of experience.
Absolutely. What do you say to those parents that sort of say they don't go out on camping trips, they don't go to the park, they don't go on nature walks? What do you say to those parents that sort of think their kids should be kept indoors and where it's nice and safe and off the street?
No, I said just, you know, live a little, give it a go. It's fantastic. I think the whole family can get something out of doing that, stuff like that. And I know it's, you know, research has shown that kids don't get out there like they used to. They don't climb trees, you know, because it's dangerous. They might fall off. But, you know, doing things like that, just getting out there, you know, just tell the kids to get out of the house and, you know, go and play in the backyard, because there's things that you can't even see in your, you know, your, no matter how big or small it is. But, you know, in our backyard, just yesterday I saw there's a beautiful, and we've only just moved, so this is a kind of a new environment for us, but, you know, we've got a resident blue-tongued lizard, and I think it's so special just to see something like that, you know, and, you know, the kookaburras, and it's just exciting. So I think you don't see that if you're looking at a screen. You don't get that opportunity. So, yeah, mums and dads, you know, it might be a little bit of tough love, but I think, yeah, set some boundaries for the kids.
Absolutely. So obviously the backyard is the best place for the kids to start, isn't it? To get out there, experience what's in their own backyard, if not maybe join a local community group, scouts, those sorts of things, to get out there and be involved out in the open, get them away from those screens and those buttons and get them to really experience what life
We're
is all
mission.
About. Yeah, find those snails. Climb those trees. Honestly, Stacey, I couldn't agree anymore.
No, well, it's true. The thing is, our backyards, as we all know, the backyards are shrinking. We don't have what we used to have. Everything's a little bit more, you know, for some people it's more manicured or there's more concrete or, you know, but if it's not your backyard, it can be the local park. And the thing is, you can go and supervise. It's even lovely to go down and let the kids run around, but you can still be there, but you don't have to have them on a lead. But, you know, you can still supervise without, you know, if you're worried about the danger and stuff like that. So I just think, you know, check out the local creek, and it's just amazing. You know, it's great to see kids get lost in nature.
Stacey, it's been an absolute pleasure having you part of the program today. Thank you again so much.
Well, it's been great to finally talk to you.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for your time. It's highly valued, and of course, you are highly valued in this industry. So well done. Thank you for your amazing contribution, and keep on inspiring those young people who are all behind you.
Well, it's that time that we truly love. It's Jerry's Jars.
Ding, ding, ding.
What's in Jerry's Jars today? So Jer has brought us in a wee plastic baggie.
I have.
What is in that, Jerry?
Well, there's a couple of herbs in there, one which everybody will be familiar with, and I can see you're pouring it out there.
Can
that gives
hear
it that distinctive
Hot
colour.
Tea. There you go. Ooh, it's sort of like, it's sort of
nice.
Urine coloured, really.
It
but
is, isn't it?
Well, that's the mint.
But that's nice.
Now, there's two things in it. The mint is there to revive you after a hot day's gardening.
I'm already revived.
Yeah.
Instantly.
It's Moroccan mint, and it's a particular variety of Mentha spicata, which I got from the Seed Savers Network many years ago.
It's very strong, isn't it?
Oh, look, if you just have pure mint tea, it will act as a decongestant if you've got a cold.
I think it's taking my fingernail polish off, actually.
It's actually
not that strong.
Mint is extremely good for digestion.
It is.
I'm about to digest. Jerry, you sure there's nothing dangerously psychotropic about this?
There's the other component is a calmative.
Oh.
It's not supposed to make you giggle.
Okay.
It's supposed to make you calm
down.
Don't
think it's working.
I laugh when I'm close to death, and I'm sort of fearful any time I'm trying some crazy thing Jerry's brought out of his garden, because I just think, is there going to be four people running around, you know, in some sort of deranged state shortly?
Well, if you keep talking like that, I'm not going to offer you cuttings, because it's a lovely purple colour, one of them is. It's flame nettle, otherwise known as coleus. And not many people know that you can eat coleus leaves.
Now, I saw you mentioning this on TV. Yeah. Are you on TV sometimes, Jerry?
Occasionally.
Yeah. I remember you mentioning this on TV. Now, I was actually quite surprised to hear that because I was also one of those people that had not realised that you could actually drink or consume coleus. Yeah. I know it's a member of the family, but I thought, okay. And I had an inkling that parts of Asia did eat certain species, but not sure of most of them.
It took me a while to work out what it was because once it's been put into tea, it's been chopped up. There's not much you can see. But I saw people selling coleus leaves for making into tea, and they're used like perilla in stir fries in Vietnam. And the ones that they tend to grow for tea making are quite plain and ordinary. They're not the decorative ones that we have.
I see.
I normally grow coleus because the blue flowers are really potent attractors of bees.
Absolutely.
So that's why it's got a role in my... I've always got it in my garden.
Yeah, yeah.
But when I went to Vietnam in June, I discovered so many different things. There was golden cosmos, the cosmos sulfureus,
yes,
which we all grow for the flowers.
Yes.
That leaves are eaten, and they're quite bitter, and they're put into spring rolls. And I've been growing this almost all my life and never realised you could eat it.
And they say the bitter herbs are the ones that are often best for you because they have a lot of good effects.
Well, this is true. I mean, the bitterness in things like radicchio, for example, if you have that in a salad just before you have a main course, it stimulates the flow of gastric juices, which makes it easier to digest fat in a meal. So their role and the time that you eat them is important to get the best effects from them. But look, just to round off with this tea, you can mix the coleus leaves and the mint leaves. Mint can vary in its flavour. There's such a large range of different types of mint. If this particular Moroccan mint is too strong, try something which is a little bit gentler. I like to add a little bit of lime juice to it because it colours it pink. And that makes it look much nicer. And honey is always my favourite sweetener for these teas. But you put them together, you've got a nice calming tea which refreshes you at the same time. So this is one of the things, along with turmeric tea, these are the two things that I'll have after I've spent a hard day out in the garden.
Could I just say, I'll be the first to openly say, and those people that are listening to me now will know because of me, with my past presidency of the Queensland Herb Society, I was never one for herbal tea. I'm a coffee man. Mm. This is very pleasant.
Yeah, it is beautiful.
And I'm really enjoying it. Good. And there's no sweetener in it, which it doesn't make me want to have a sweetener at all. I don't need the honey or the sugar. It's very, very pleasant. So thank you for bringing it in.
Oh, cool.
I'm very calm now.
You know I only tease you in Jerry's jars.
I know you do.
You stop laughing now, haven't
you? I thought I'd better behave.
It's calming you right down.
I'm calm. It's very nice.
Right now, Queensland Gardening Hour is joined by a man who is obsessed with beautiful bulbs, but not just any type of bulb. The pride of Mick Maguire is hippiastrums, and he joins us now. Good morning, Mick.
Good morning, Jerry.
How's life in sunny Wumbai?
Oh, it's pretty good. It's nice and sunny, beautiful day out here. It's probably reached 30 degrees, I think.
It's definitely spring in the Sunshine Coast.
Yes, it is.
Last year, we popped along with Gardening Australia to film your farm, which had been on my list of things to do for probably about 8 years. And when we finally got around to seeing your farm, I was absolutely blown away by the size of it and the diversity of hippiastrums that you were growing. Where did it all start?
It goes back. I've always had a soft spot for bulbs. This goes back to probably my school days. I've always been a bit of a gardener, but I visited a nursery in Brisbane some years ago. He had tropical bulbs, which were things I was interested in. And he told me to come back in October when all the hippiastrums would be out. Now, this didn't impress me at all. I mean, red for white stripes or white for red stripes. But anyway, I went along and I walked into his shade and I was gobsmacked by the stuff he had there. But by standards of the day, it was absolutely beautiful. And he sort of talked to me about it, and we talked to him, and we decided to have a go at a more extensive breeding program to see what we could come up with. And that's where we started from.
And over the years, you've produced an enormous range, but you've tended to focus on certain colours and certain forms, more like the double forms of Hippiastrum. Is that because there weren't enough of them, or because you particularly like them?
Some of the early ones I didn't like, but I sort of looked at them and I thought maybe I could improve on those. I know that was being a bit optimistic, but anyway, we had to go at it, and took us probably 6 or 7 years, and we started to turn out really good bulbs, and we've been doing it ever since. But I love the doubles now. They're absolutely beautiful.
Now, if I was to recommend bulbs to people, would you say that Hippiastrums would be one of the best ones to choose, one of the first ones to choose?
They're the most spectacular by far. There's nothing matches them in beauty and size. Colour.
And how about ease for growing? What would you recommend people would, where would they plant them? How would they grow them?
Right, just dig your garden up. Spade depth is plenty. If you can get hold of a bit of horse manure, that's good. Dig that in, or a bit of compost. Stay away from chemical fertilisers. Put the bulb into the ground. Bury it up to the neck, but not over the neck.
Mm-hmm.
Throw a bucket of water on it. And it'll look after itself pretty well after that.
That sounds deceptively easy. Are there any downsides to them?
Yes. Snails love them. Now, what the snail will do, the bud will come up out of the ground and he'll gnaw at it. As soon as it comes out, he'll do that every night and you'll never see that flower. The other one is mealybugs.
Mm-hmm.
They can be seen by sort of a white mildewy effect. And if you don't destroy that fellow, he will suck the juice out of the leaves, out of the bulb, and the leaves will all distort, and you think you've got a terrible virus there.
Right.
But it, you knock them out, you spray them twice over a period of about 14 days, and that usually knocks them out. We do get a problem occasionally with crinum grubs.
Yep.
They're a minor. They get into the leaf. He looks like a Collingwood footballer. He's black and white stripes. And he will go into that bulb eventually if you leave him there. He'll dig a hole in the bulb. Bulb fills up with water. That's the only thing I know of that'll actually kill a Hippiastrum.
Right. So apart from those three things, which are quite easily managed, they're pretty much a trouble-free plant. Do you open to the public so people can come along and buy them, or do you just do mail order for your bulbs?
We do mail order. As well as people coming in, there's people in now, there's quite a few. We're open 7 days a week at the moment, from 8:30 to 4:30.
Right.
And we'll stay there till probably mid-November, but the best time is over the next 2 weeks.
Right.
When they're going to be at their best.
So we've caught you just at the right time to look at the farm and buy
right
the plants.
Yeah, yes.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Now, what's your address and your phone number, Mick, just in case people want to call and drop by?
409 Kiel, K-I-E-L. Mountain Road, Wombai, W-O-M-B-Y-E. And the phone number is 07-54-485-640.
That's fantastic. Now, I did a quick check on Wikipedia before we did this interview, and they reckon that there are 600 different varieties of Hippiastrum on Earth. And when we were doing our research to film your place, we noted that you have 400. So either Wikipedia are radically wrong, or you are Mr. Hippiastrum worldwide.
My wife settled me on my ego's too big now, so I won't comment.
Well, look, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I do hope people come along and have a look at your Hippiastrums. It really is an eye-opener. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, Jerry, thanks for the call.
Bye for now.
Boys, let's move on to another listener question. Have you got one, Noel?
Well, one of the questions that have been thrown at me lately, and I'm happy to grab onto this question any amount of times as I like because it's right up my alley,
yeah.
And this is about how to attract more pollinators and bees into the garden.
Absolutely.
So this is something that I love to carry a flag for as much as I possibly can. And that, of course, is to plant particular species of plants or families. So I think sometimes it's easier for people to be conditioned to grow different types of flowers, but sometimes looking at particular families of plants or groupings can often have a greater effect.
That's interesting.
So, and one of the easiest plants that anybody, any easiest families, I think, that any member of the public can get their hands on are the daisy family.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I've actually done a post this morning on my Facebook page about that.
So do you think, like, families of plants look good together too?
Yes and no, depending on their colour scheme, of course, and their shape, because they all vary. Now, daisies make up over 23,000 different species, and they cover over 1,600 genera of plants, okay? So they are worldwide. They come from the humblest of little lawn weeds right through to the most flamboyant of sunflowers, okay?
Really big. Sunflowers are daisies, aren't they?
Absolutely. Oh. So all members of the Compositae family or Asteraceae family.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not speaking anything different to what Mr. Colby Williams here knows about already.
You boys can swing those Latin names around.
But the thing is, daisies are something that we all take for granted, and yet cast your mind back, you know, the old song, I'll give you a daisy, I'll give you a daisy a day, or give you a daisy, my darling, something like that. And then, of course, we made those daisy chains without realising that how important a role they actually play in the ecology of life. Daisies in our garden will always undoubtedly bring the widest selection of pollinators and bees into our garden, plus also predators like hoverflies and wasps and all those sorts of things. So that is the easiest family that anybody can start with if they're thinking about really encouraging a strong ecology or bringing those pollinators into their backyards, especially if they've got productive fruit trees.
Is there native daisies?
Absolutely. There are daisies native to virtually every continent in the world.
Interesting.
Yes. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, my love of daisies just went up tenfold when I came to Western Australia for the very first time, and it was a daisy spring. There's so many paper daisies which are native to Australia that I got interested in when I was in England, because you grow them in summer and you dry the flowers and they bring a bit of cheer during winter. But this concept that you were talking about earlier, Noel, about classifying plants and getting people to understand which families they belong to, that was how I started my life at Kew Gardens. And the very first place I worked was the order beds, where each bed was set out by a different plant family.
Wow.
And in answer to your question, LJ, about how well they associate with each other, is sometimes very well, sometimes not at all, because families is a huge area. So you might have trees, or you might have tiny little annuals. Some may be tropical, some may require Arctic conditions, and you have to work through it. But the thing that Noel was talking about was they have a constant factor, which is the flower shape and the fact that the flower is designed to be insect pollinated in the Asteraceae. That's what that sunny sunflower look, that little smiling daisy face, that's one of the things that any gardener can recognise. And it's important to use those little characteristics to learn your way around the different families of plants. And when you've got that basic understanding, then you can go out down the street and you can identify which family it belongs to, even if you don't know its proper
name.
That's
exactly right.
How interesting.
Daisies are made up in the central zone. In the centre there, what we see is the middle of the plant.
Yeah.
That's where the actual flowers are, in tiny little rosettes and little intricate patterns. The actual petals are what we see initially, but that's there only to just attract the likes of an insect.
Oh,
to come,
come
and
flags,
land on
hey?
Me. That's what they are.
Yeah.
The actual flowers are minute and into the centre.
I love what you had to say about families there, Jerry, because it's just like a human family, isn't it? You know, all so different, yet there's something that holds us all together. And what about you? Have you got a question there from somebody?
Well, I've got two fairly quick ones. One was from Kathy of Brisbane, and this was through my website. She wanted to ask me how I got the permission to plant my nature strip as a garden.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And I had to explain to her that I arrived in Brisbane in 2003, and at that time, I put in a development application for the whole of my property, including my nature strip and the trees which were planted there, and I got permission from Brisbane City Council to do it. So it was possible then to negotiate with the council. But we have a Natural Assets Act in Brisbane, and that actually now has been amended to forbid people from doing what I've done in my nature strip.
No.
Yes, absolutely. And there is an $800 fine if you put a trowel into that turf. And that's the risk that you take. Now, there are lots of nature strip gardens around Brisbane.
Yeah,
there's a lot of people that don't know about this, and there are a few people that just want to beautify the nature strips by putting nature into it.
I always love it when I walk through a beautiful garden that extends out.
I get comments like this all the time. I'm behind the hedge, so they don't know I'm in the garden, and I hear people make comments about how park-like it is to have the nature strip gardens. But people do so at risk. The risk of being fined, and you have to negotiate with your council. Not all councils are the same. Some councils are more supportive of it, but certainly if anybody wants to do it, I think it's a lovely idea, but you do need to get permission, otherwise you could be in trouble.
Good to know.
The other question that I've got is another sort of seasonal thing. Tanya got me through Facebook, and she lives in Wynnum, my suburb. And she said, there's a beautiful old fig tree along Fox Street, Wynnum, in Green Park in front of the restaurant. I've admired it for years. I drove past today. It's dropped all its leaves. It looks terrible. What would cause this to happen? It looks like it's dying. So I thought I knew the tree, and I just dropped down there and took some photographs, and it is a strangler fig. It's one of the Australian species of strangler fig which have adapted to dry rainforest. Now, dry rainforest is not often talked about, but it's a very complex, very diverse group of plants which form different habitats all the way around the east coast and the north coast of Australia. And they've developed in response to the current dry spell that we go through. Every spring in Brisbane is dry. It's the same down in Sydney to different degrees all the way around the north and east coasts. And plants have formed communities which rest during this dry period. So this tree is a lovely old white fig, Ficus virens. It's responding to the spring drought by dropping its leaves, and it will only do so for about 2, possibly 3 weeks at the most before it puts on a new crown and grows.
But, yeah, we haven't had a spring drought.
Well, they are responding to it in just the same way that a deciduous tree in the Northern Hemisphere, they go through a drought in a winter when the water is unavailable because it's frozen, but they still drop their leaves even if you don't get the soil frozen. It's a conditioned response due to temperature and day length. And with the figs, they're not so responsive to day length, but what they do respond to is moisture content in the soil. And the areas where they develop, they always go through a spring and winter drought, and they will get the rains, the storms as they arrive during late spring and summer.
So this is sort of conditioned habit for the tree. If conditions change, it still has to do it.
It still goes through that same repetitive cycle. And this gives them a really distinct advantage over evergreen figs. Evergreen figs are also Australian species, and they occur in wet rainforests, but they don't drop their leaves. And if they suffer from pest diseases like lerps, mealybugs, scale, all sorts of common garden problems, they can stay on their leaves all year round. But with things like the white fig, they shed the problem every year and they start anew. So down in Sydney Botanic Gardens, we had an avenue along Hospital Road, which was planted with evergreen Moreton Bay figs. When they started to fail because of lerp attack, a sap-sucking pest, we replaced them with white figs. So every year we've got a self-cleaning avenue of fig trees, and they're just as native as the Moreton Bay figs, but far more successful.
And so you just have to remove all those leaves and make sure you got rid of the problem at the same time.
Oh, you remove the leaves and you make wonderful compost.
Interesting.
Well, our nursery of the week, Jerry, this time around, is Palms for Brisbane. This is a very long-standing business in the eastern suburbs of Brisbane. And, of course, we're speaking to the owner, Greg Smith. Welcome, Greg, to the program.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, fellas.
Good morning. I saw some of your plants in Barcaldine a few weeks ago at the garden of Jane and Greg Castle.
Greg's an occasional customer.
Your plants certainly get around, and you grow some really unusual things. In fact, you're a bit of a go-to garden centre, aren't you?
Well, we try to be different. We don't grow many plants. We do grow the palms ourselves, but you know, despite our name, we're not just palms. We very quickly realised we couldn't make a living out of just palms, but we do confine ourselves to tropical garden style.
That's right. Greg, you've got a great reputation. Well, your business has a fantastic reputation with a lot of tropical style gardeners out there for, like Jerry said, the go-to place for those unusual species. Lots of tropical plants that I've never seen anywhere else apart from you. And when I have seen them, they in other people's gardens, they have originated from you. So well done for that. Can you just give us a quick rundown on some of those unusual things that you do carry from time to time?
Well, you know, people still tend to use the palms for canopy and for structure in a tropical garden, but we do carry the tree ferns and some of the dicots, the branching or the rainforest trees. We like the native gardenia or the randia. We carry a dwarf version of that as well as the regular one that you see around. But, you know, to complement the backbone of the tropical garden, we have a large range of tropical foliage colour, the aroids, the cordylines, the bromeliads, dracaena, croton, you know, that whole range of associated tropical plants.
One of the things I love about your place is the cycads that you sell. You have so many, and at small sort of sizes, so it's quite easy to start a collection that you can grow on a windowsill.
Yeah, we try to offer our whole range of plants in a different sizes to suit individual budgets. And the cycads are no exception.
Yeah. Now, Greg, do you run any particular events at your nursery? Do you have special open days when you're trying to promote a particular, a gardening event or anything like that? Or do you lock into other gardening events as well?
Yeah, no, we don't tend to have special events on site, but we very closely involved with the Palm and Cycad Society, and particularly with the International Cordyline Society. So we're great supporters of their events at Mount Coosa and out at Cleveland. We're generally busy, and that's the way we like it.
Greg, what are your business hours, and where are you situated for those people that are going to be, and I know they will be, enthusiastic to get out to see what you have to offer?
Well, we are open 7 days, 8:30 till 4:30, and our nursery is at 451 Lytton Road, Morningside.
Right, well, that's very easy for a lot of people to get to, so it's...
Yeah, we're one of the closest nurseries to the Brisbane CBD. Mm.
You're one of the few local ones to Wynnum, where I am. There's very little to get to. So
I guess a real competitive advantage, apart from our continually changing range of tropical plants, is our staff and the design work they do and the advice they give to our customers, that independent nurseries are more capable of doing that than some of the bigger chain stores. But you know, that's really where we get our repeat business, and people, you know, with wanting to create a new garden with a new and different feel to it, you know.
Well, it's an absolute credit to you and your entire team there at Palms of Brisbane there, Greg, because, you know, without the people with all your knowledge and without your staff, people just wouldn't keep going there. And that's what they're really in need of in today's world. So,
absolutely.
Well done. So that's something that can be really, really proud of.
And you are also online. So anybody that is looking for something which is really distinctive in the line of tropical foliage plants, they can actually see before they drop in, can't they?
They certainly can. Jerry, www.palmsforbrisbane.com.au.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Greg.
Well, we have had really unusual spring rain here in Brisbane in September. In September. So I'm just wondering, boys, what jobs should people be looking at doing in the garden now?
This is the best time of the year, October, November, to get out there and prune your azaleas and lightly prune your camellias. They put on their, especially camellias, they're putting on their once-a-year growth spurt at this time. This is also the best time to give them a light feeding. Camellias don't need a lot of feeding, but this is the time to do it.
Noel, can I just ask you, you're saying to prune, but they're putting on their growth spurt now. So you mean prune you can today?
Well, azaleas in particular have virtually come into the end of their flowering now. Some are still growing quite strong, but as soon as they've gone over, it's the time to give them a nice light prune by about a third, and you feed them directly at the same time. Camellias are putting on a new growth spurt, but if you don't curb that enthusiasm in the camellia, they'll just grow little thin whips. So you need to tip prune them as they grow. They only put on this growth spurt at this time of the year, and they also only require their fertiliser during this time, so October, November, and that will give them the strength to put on the flower buds, which actually start to form around Christmas, which is the crucial time of the year when you need to keep the moisture up to them. Otherwise, those little buds will turn into leaf growth next autumn.
So it's
a crucial time of the year for azaleas, and or more so for camellias, but it's a great time to give them all a bit of a prune and a feed.
And what about all of the spectacular bottle brush and grevilleas that are all just putting on the most amazing show at the moment?
Do
they need a similar pruning afterwards?
Absolutely. There's no harm in pruning a native plant. This is something that's an old husband's tale, I think, that you don't prune them. And I think because he wants to stay inside and watch the footy. But personally, you need to. As soon as they're finished blooming, give them a chop just behind those flowers and you'll find that they'll bush up beautifully. It also rejuvenates them. It keeps them young. Treat them or think of them as a bit like a rose in that respect, where they'll want to put on new fresh growth. And that fresh growth is less prone to getting attacked by insects and disease. So when they're active and they're happy, they actually naturally build up their toxins.
Interesting. And what will you get up to shortly?
Well, my focus is with my citrus at the moment. All of my citrus are flowering, so mandarins, lemons, limes, the lemonade tree, which Noel gave me a couple of years, they've all bloomed. And when they have started to set fruit, there's a critical period with citrus where you don't apply a fertilizer containing nitrogen, because until those fruit are pea-sized at least, or bigger than a pea size, if you give them too much nitrogen, they'll put on a lot of lush leafy growth, they'll look gorgeous, but they'll drop their fruit.
And so what happens in that instance? Will then the cycle just shift back a little bit? Will you get some fruit after the lush growth?
If it's a mandarin variety which only flowers and fruits once in a year, then you've lost a year's worth of fruit, so it's quite important. For limes, I mean, my lime tree is currently producing its fifth crop of fruit this year. That will be a setback, but it won't be a disaster. So look, just give them iron chelates or iron sulfate. They need iron. I give them Epsom salts as well, and I put a couple of teaspoonfuls of each into 4.5 litres of water, and I sprinkle that widely around the root zone underneath the tree. Both magnesium and iron are needed for plants to make chlorophyll, and chlorophyll allows them to capture the sun's energy and convert it into fruit. So that's the thing that I'm going to do.
I'm going to do that, Jerry.
I want to enhance their vigour and improve my crops. And in maybe about 6 weeks' time, when the fruit are slightly larger, then I can give them a balanced organic fertiliser. And that's what I will do every 6 weeks.
Beautiful. All right. Well, we come to the end of this podcast of the Queensland Gardening Hour. It's a real pleasure getting the opportunity to speak to you. And hopefully this is going out to around the world. It's interesting, isn't it? But we're hoping that people are interested about gardening and specifically gardening here in the subtropics. And if you're in some cold, chilly place, maybe you'll be able to get some pleasure from thinking of the warmth that we've got here. So it's been lovely to chat to you from Noel Burdett, Jerry Colby-Williams and myself, LJ Stockwell. We'll talk to you on the next podcast.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.